So welcome to Lecture 24, November 21st, Lecture Notes, page 216. When I put the image of the soccer ball and the USA playing in the World Cup up, it was 1-0. But minutes ago in, what did you say, was a penalty shot? Wales has it. It's 1-1. I'm sorry about that. I can't control it. So there we go. Happy Thanksgiving. So we don't have class, of course, on Wednesday. The APL drive is ongoing. I did see some nice stuff donated outside the dean's office. If you want to help out with the animals, you can donate either outside room 306, the dean's office, or down in 107, College of Business Undergraduate Advising Office. If you're interested in work in the media area, that's still up and running. So we have class today, yay, and then no class Wednesday, even bigger, yay. And then I'll see you back next Monday. Hopefully you'll have a happy, safe Thanksgiving doing something good with turkey. So here's a newbie for you. More extra credit points. You, of course, on your own, Webbies, you paying attention? You, of course, on your own should fill out the flash survey evaluation for every course that you get. And presumably, if they do what they're supposed to do, you're getting regular email reminders. But I've added a course evaluation link in Canvas. Click on it, evaluate the class, which you should do anyhow. I cannot give you individual credit for participating because it is indeed anonymous. I can't tell you, I can't tell how good or bad you're saying my course is. But I can see the percentage participation rate for the overall class. If we get to 100%, it is to laugh. Everyone in the course will get an extra 0.5% added to their final course grade. If we get 75% participation, everyone will get 0.375 added to their course of grade. That's 75% times 0.5. And say we only got 25% or 50% participation, everyone will get 0.25% added to their grade. So when you have a chance, do the course evaluation. Help me out, seeing what you like, what you don't like, what I should improve, what I should, you know, change. By the way, I always say, while everybody wants to get all top numbers, the important thing is what you have to tell me, the typing stuff, which is where I actually hear what's good, what's bad, what needs changed, et cetera. So that's, if you can take an extra minute, although I don't, it doesn't matter in whether or not you get credit for participating, but the comments are useful. Questions on how you get extra points there. The thing stays open until the Sunday following the date I have, what's the date I have? Date Tuesday, December 6th. That's when I want to do the scoring. After December 6th, Tuesday, it stays all the way open until that next Sunday, but after that, I want to get the points done and posted. So, by December 6th. Test results, ongoing. Mini test 11 closed on schedule. Average score 88%. Number of students participating 93%. 12 will open tomorrow, which technically is on it. Which technically is on its regular schedule. And what? But of course, because we have Thanksgiving break in there, I'm going to keep it open for the usual number of days. So it'll be open Tuesday, and then we come back Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, actually an extra day, Thursday. So it's open for 5 days, technically, to the Thursday after Thanksgiving. Gives you plenty of time to get back, catch up, get rid of that turkey, and take the test. So that's 12 of 13, and then 13 will open up that Thursday. What else can I tell you? Enhancing extra credit. Oh, so you saw the note from me. Actually, somebody did what I asked them to do, checked their grades, noticed an error, and as you saw by email, in fact, apparently there was a muck-up on extra credit or extra credit number 5. So I went back and checked that. Indeed, a bunch of people, for some reason, it didn't get posted. So hopefully you all saw a note on that. You didn't see a note? Did see a note? So if you didn't get credit before, hopefully you have credit now. Always check your grades. Let me know if there's an error. Business in the news. Any Taylor Swift fans? Just one Taylor Swift fan in the entire organization, so you don't care about this then. So, anybody know about Ticketmaster? Okay, more people know about that. So, lawmakers slam Ticketmaster after Taylor Swift pre-sale struggles. For Taylor Swift fans, Tuesday, November 15th presented a series of frustrating challenges when Ticketmaster, the vendor for the singer's highly anticipated Eras Tour, could not handle the influx of pre-sale customers, forcing would-be concertgoers to wait in hours-long digital lines, and sometimes they still couldn't get into the site. So we're seeing the obvious lack of customer service. We're seeing a bad customer experience. And of course, we're talking about channel of distribution right now. That's the chapter we're in. Here's a channel of distribution for the tickets between the artist, Taylor Swift, and the consumer. So our friends at Ticketmaster are in the channel of distribution. For a handful of lawmakers in Congress, the fiasco represented a much wider problem, that of massive companies merging with others and exerting a monopoly on the market. In response, a slew of Democrats called on both the Department of Justice and the FTC to investigate Ticketmaster's practices. So on the one hand, we see corporate growth strategies. We're a big company. Let's grow. Let's merge with another big company. Yay! And then let's get monopoly power in the marketplace. Not so good. So that's where we bump up into that little crest factor of regulatory, legal, and political factors. Monopolies wreak havoc on consumers and our economies, says Senator Amy Klobuchar. When there is no competition to incentivize better service and fair prices, we all suffer the consequences. So this is the results of a lack of competition in the marketplace. Republican David Sincelline, I don't know, wrote to Ticketmaster and his parent company, Live Nation, are leveraging their position in the primary channel of distribution to drive out competition in the resale market and allowing for potentially unfair and deceptive practices. Those are a couple legal phrases relevant to the law. Unfair and deceptive, then we got you, if that's true. According to a 2019 report from the Government Accountability Office, Ticketmaster controlled over 80% of the primary ticketing across the U.S. for concerts, sports games, and other major events. The company also held the second largest market share in the secondary ticket sales behind StubHub. Seems like they have a lot of power in the channel of distribution, eh? FTC broadly prohibits unfair or deceptive acts or practices in or affecting commerce, meaning it can enforce regulations against companies who violate those federal standards, but it's largely up to the individual states to investigate the claims of deceptive practices. Officials in at least one state are already looking into some of those complaints. On Saturday, Ticketmaster did put out a statement defending their situation, noting that the failure of their usually high-quality service was really just the result of extraordinary high demand for tickets. What will happen? Don't know. Stay tuned for the future of Ticketmaster and monopoly regulation. From the Don't Lie, Don't Cheat, Don't Steal department in Marketing of the News, who heard about the sentencing for Elizabeth Holmes? Just one person. So Elizabeth Holmes was sentenced to more than 11 years for fraud, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, in the classroom, in your personal life, in business. Elizabeth Holmes, the founder of the failed blood test startup Theranos, was sentenced to more than 11 years in prison last Friday for defrauding investors about her company's technology and business dealings. So this does fit in the category of business ethics, or lack thereof. The trial ignited debates about Silicon Valley's culture of hype and exaggeration. Ms. Holmes, who raised $945 million for Theranos and promised that the startup would revolutionize healthcare with tests that required just a few drops of blood, was convicted in January of four counts of fraud for deceiving investors with those claims, which turned out to be lies. They weren't true. She made it up. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. It can have consequences. Prosecutors had urged Judge Davila to consider the message that her case would send to the world. They wrote that a long sentence for Ms. Holmes was important to deter future startup fraud schemes and rebuild the trust investors must have when funding innovators. This court sentence, shows that courts take fraud seriously. So here's legal factors in business and marketing. Exaggeration and hype are common among high-tech startups, but very few executives are actually indicted on fraud charges, let alone convicted and sent to prison. That trend, though, may be changing, as the Justice Department says it has plans to be more aggressive in its pursuit of white-collar criminals. So businesses and marketers need to track changing trends in the crest factors, in this case, regulatory, legal, and political factors that may influence them. In October, Trevor Milton, was the founder of electric vehicle company Nikola, was convicted of fraud. Sam Bankman-Fried, the founder of cryptocurrency exchange FTX, which we talked about, collapsed in bankruptcy last week, is under multiple state and federal investigations. So don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal in business. Just provide value by satisfying consumers honestly. Shouldn't have to say that multiple times a semester, but I do. Speaking of FTX and the whole cryptocurrency domain, I thought this was an interesting follow-up story. But Binance launches a major campaign following FTX's collapse, and it stars Ronaldo. Everybody know Ronaldo, yeah? Okay. So he's a football player, a soccer player. While the fallout from last week's collapse of crypto exchange FTX has halted activity across much of the crypto ecosystem, Binance is stepping on the gas. The world's largest crypto exchange has launched a global marketing campaign, the first in the brand's five-year history. So we're seeing global marketing, competition in the marketplace. The campaign is headlined by a 67-spot featuring soccer star Cristiano Ronaldo, with whom Binance just announced an NFT collection. So we're seeing a celebrity partnership. Who does know what an NFT is? Who doesn't know what an NFT is? Okay. I need to digress for just a minute to bring you up to date with Web3 and the world of NFTs. NFTs are non-fungible tokens. They are things that you pay a little or a huge amount of money for online. They are typically images, icons, pictures. Anybody else think of something? I guess it could be a document that you own digitally, meaning anybody can see it, anybody can copy it, anybody can put up a picture of whatever your picture is, but you own it. Sometimes people say, what are you talking about? So could you go to the Mona Lisa and see it in Paris? Could you see the Mona Lisa there? Yeah. Could you take a picture of the Mona Lisa? Yeah. Could you post that picture? You could. Would you own the Mona Lisa? You would not. It's owned by the museum, right? So the same logic applies here. The person who pays a little or a lot of money for an NFT on the internet are the only person that owns the image, even though they can be able to see it, copy it, use it, but you own it. How much money is that worth to you? Well, funny you should ask. Let's move along in the world of NFTs. So let's see the spot with Ronaldo hyping his NFTs offering.
We all have a great story to tell. One that starts with a humble beginning, where we work hard, dream big.
Take note of these statues.
And learn to believe in ourselves. Where we rise to every challenge. That's how we can change the game. And together, we can exchange the world. This is where our story begins. Join me on Binance. To the moon.
Okay. Though, from what I understand, the digital NFT can get are versions of those statues you just saw, which represent key moments in Ronaldo's life. So Binance is running the spot in various lengths across TV, digital, and social channels in 74 countries and 28 languages. The campaign scope and choice of star power will seek to attract the attention during the ongoing FIFA World Cup, which began last weekend and lasts through December 18th. So global marketing and media channels. So let's look at this offering. Ronaldo's first NFT collection became available last Friday as part of an exclusive multi-year partnership with Binance, the world's leading blockchain ecosystem and cryptocurrency infrastructure provider. The launch is supported by a global marketing campaign we just saw featuring Ronaldo, aiming to give his fans an introduction to Web3 through the world of NFTs, non-fungible tokens. So we're seeing a marketing partnership here. The inaugural Ronaldo NFT collection features seven animated statues with four rarity levels. Super rare, SSR, super rare, SR, rare, R, and normal, N. Each of these statues depicts Ronaldo in an iconic moment from his life, from career-defining bicycle kicks to his childhood in Portugal. The 45 highest value NFTs, those are five super rare, and 40 super rare will be held for auction on the Binance NFT marketplace. The auction will remain open for 24 hours with NFTs awarded to the highest bidder. Bidding prices will start at, write this one down for yourself, 10,000 BUSDs for a super, super rare thing, and 1,700 BSDs for the super rare. A BSD is a fiat-backed stable coin issued by Binance and Paxos. Each BSD token is backed one-to-one with U.S. dollars held in reserve, so hypothetically there's actually money behind those crypto dollars you're using. So the remaining 6,600 NFTs, 600 rare and 6,000 normal, will be offered on Binance starting at 77 BUSDs for the normal rarity. So here's price in the mix, $10,000 for an NFT, and auctions as part of a way to sell product. So anybody can jump online for one of these? It's Ronaldo, dude. No? You might be able to auction one. Never mind. All right, so there's the world of the future. Good luck with that. Lecture notes, page 216, 404 in the textbook. We're talking about the third P of the marketing mix, which is place or channel of distribution. And we'll pick up where we left off with any luck. Yep. All right, so what is the nature and the importance of marketing channels? What is a marketing channel? A marketing channel consists of the individuals and firms involved in the process of making a product or a service available for use or consumption by consumers or industrial users. It's how that physical product or how that service thing gets from the creator out to you. Middlemen make up the channel of distribution. They're also known as intermediaries. Middlemen are business firms in a channel that render services directly related to the sale and purchase of a product, usually a product rather than a service, as it flows from the producer to the consumer. Distribution's role within the marketing mix is getting the product to its target market. That's what it's trying to do, and it's important to you because if you can't get that ticket, toilet paper, or diamond ring, you're upset. Middlemen can promote the product down the channel out to the ultimate consumer. They can store the product. They can ship the product. And, helpful to the entire channel, they can assume some of the financial risk during that distribution process. So as a manufacturer, as we talked about last time, I think, you don't have to hang on to all the risk. They might help share in the financing. We have merchant middlemen and agent middlemen. So these are the two classifications of middlemen. Merchant middlemen take title to the products that they help to market. We touched on this previously. Why is it important who has the title to the product? We actually talked about it a little bit before. Yeah. Liability, which we talked about before. So it gets stolen, it gets broken, it falls out of fashion, it melts. Who's responsible for the thing? In this case, the merchant middlemen actually take title to the products that they're selling. And, of course, then the agent middleman act like a salesperson for the manufacturer, and they don't take title. You keep it. They're selling your product down the line. You can eliminate the middlemen, we like to say, but you can't eliminate the essential distribution activities that they perform. So sometimes you say, well, we'll just cut out the middleman. Well, that's fine. But somebody still has to store it, ship it, market it. These things still have to happen. Transactions have to occur. Now, here I'm being a little cute. How many of you guys know Radiohead? Radiohead? Quite a while ago at this point, it was a bit newer when I first did it, Radiohead ran an experiment. And the experiment was that they cut out their distribution, entity for a band. Who is the distribution entity? Say again. Can't, it doesn't, any answer does. The singer is the entity manufacturing the product. So who helps get that product out to the consumer? Traditionally, in the old days. The what? Producers related to the record label is where we're actually trying to drive to. So the record label helps produce it, helps get it distributed, get it played out there, get it to the consumer, right? To the radio stations, to the record stores, or whatever it goes to, right? So Radiohead ran an experiment a while ago in which they, quote, cut out the middleman. So let's see what the write-up here is going to tell us. Radiohead's experiment, which they let people choose how much they wanted to pay for their latest album In Rainbows, call it a publicity stunt or an innovative business model. Initial numbers show that the experiment was a success. Final numbers are in. In Rainbows sold better than their last album, selling 1.75 million of the physical CD, 100,000 box sets, 30,000 units on iTunes in the U.S. in the first week of availability. The album was number one in both the U.K. and the U.S. for the first 3 months. It was played 17 million times on Last FM. And even to whatever year this was, it was still in the top 200 in the UK and US as far as sales of the physical CD. Yes, they're a big band. Yes, their audience is not the same as, say, Shakira's. Yes, this was one of the first such experiments, and it caused a great deal of attention regardless of the music. They cut out the record label. They cut out the middleman. But they still had to do the work of getting the word out, right? So somebody is still doing some of the work. So what are the middlemen doing? Well, they serve three types of activities. Transactional functions, somebody has to do this. Logistical functions, somebody has to do that. And facilitating functions, they have to get done as well. So here I've sort of labeled it. So the sales specialist, working for the producer, for the manufacturer, provides market information back to that producer, a facilitating function, interprets the consumer's wants. How do you know if you're sitting in your shop in downtown Ravenna what the consumers in California want? Your sales specialist can help let you know. They promote the producer's products, a transactional function. They create assortment so that the final consumer gets various bits and bytes that they want, logistical. They negotiate with consumers, customers, that's transactional. Provide financing, which is facilitating. Own the product sometimes, which is facilitating. Shares the risk we talked about. For the buyer, for the ultimate, or for the retailer, or downstream, they also do these functions. They help anticipate wants, facilitating, subdivide large quantities of product, logistical, stores products, logistical, transports product, logistical, creates assortments, logistical, provides financing, facilitating, makes products readily available, logistical, guarantees the products, transactional, and shares the risk. If nobody is in the middle, somebody still has to finance it. Somebody still has to get the market information. Somebody still has to create the assortment. Somebody has to store it, and somebody has to ship it. You want to do all that, dear producer? Maybe you'd like to have somebody in the channel do that with you. Well, if you want to hear a music group here in Kent, Ohio, I presume you can't get on the phone, call them up, and say, hey, I'd like to hear your band. Come on down to Kent and play, right? That's silly. So Kent Stage, anybody ever been to a concert at the Kent Stage? They're sort of your middleman to make that happen. They do the work, they contact the people, they bring them in, they publicize it, they sell you the ticket, you go watch the show. You can't do that. They're your middleman. Distribution channels include the people and firms involved in the transfer of title to a product as the product moves from the producer to the ultimate consumer, or in the B2B world, to the business user. So here we're seeing the idea of moving the title from the producer to the middleman to the final consumer to the business user visually. The channel for a product extends only to the last person or organization that buys that product without making any significant changes to it. So that represents a channel of distribution. But if you buy the product and significantly change its form, then move it along. You have a new channel of distribution. So, if we start off with raw lumber out at Potter's Lumber and Sawmill, and we move this through the channel of distribution through a broker to a furniture maker, they buy the lumber, and they're going to convert it into something that doesn't look like lumber anymore, right? They're going to convert it into furniture. So they've changed the form of the product. Then we get a new channel of distribution as it moves from the furniture maker, Artistica, out to the furniture store that used to be here. I don't know if they've gone entirely bankrupt, Shadell, out to the ultimate consumer. So here we have two different channels of distribution. What makes them different? The physical product changed. And so we start a new channel of distribution. So there are a variety of other intermediaries that help this stuff happen. Banks obviously help with the financing. You need to borrow some money. Insurance companies help with that risk factor we keep talking about. Transportation companies, obviously, transport. You could add warehousing companies. You could add other things that help with this whole process to occur. So we have both channels of distribution in the B2C side and in the B2B side. And what's flowing through these channels? Ownership of the product, payment for the product, information about the market, and promotion of the product, whether we're in the B2B side or the B2C side or the B2B side. In order to be a channel, you have to have at least, at least a consumer, a buyer, and a producer. If you only have one of those things, you don't have much of a channel. So you need to have at least a consumer and a producer. If that's all you have, a producer and a consumer, it's called a direct channel of distribution, direct from the producer to the consumer. And certainly we know about that. So here I'm, in my little arrows, I'm showing you direct channels of distribution on the consumer side, the left-hand side from the producer to the consumer, on the right-hand side from the producer to the business customer. Each one represents a direct channel of distribution. We're going to talk about a couple entities that engage in direct marketing a little bit, both on the B2C and the B2B side. We'll just pass by that for the moment. Oh, there we go. So let's look at a B2C direct channel example. So the producer to the consumer is a direct channel. Lots of online companies do this. Before the internet, there was a company that went by the title 1-800-Flowers. So you could dial up anywhere in the country and have them deliver directly from their shop to your friend, to your loved one. It was so popular that they kept it once we got on the internet. So 1-800-Flowers.com, direct to the consumer. You can get cards directly from AmericanGreetingCards.com. You can get organic butter and cheese at that link. It's sent directly to the consumer. And telephone sales, which are, of course, harder and harder to do because nobody picks up their phone for spam calls, but in the B2C world, that's hard to do. B2B, you can still do it direct to the customer. You can go to the Dell website, customize your order directly from Dell. We talked about mass customization way long time ago. You can order up directly from them to you. Anybody ever been to a house party, like for Avon, home party, house party, that sort of thing? Yeah. Cosmetics or Tupperware or baskets? Baking stuff. So there are a lot of these good-sized companies, actually, that will do a home party. And their sales rep, working for them, invites you usually to a neighbor's house or a friend's house. You have a little socialization, a little social party, and, of course, you know they're going to ask you to buy something after the socialization. So these guys have home or office parties. They've gotten tougher to do, of course, during COVID, and some of them are moving to Facebook groups with the same idea, direct from them to the ultimate consumer. We also see the idea of a channel of producer, final customer, and at least one intermediary. This is no longer a direct channel. It's now an indirect channel. So, for example, Dell, who we just said a minute ago, you could buy directly from in a direct channel of distribution. Also, as you know, they'll sell you a computer through an intermediary like Walmart. You go to Walmart store, you can buy a Dell computer, yeah, Best Buy. And so they become an intermediary, so directly from Dell to Walmart to the retail store out to the consumer becomes an indirect channel. So from the producer through a retailer to the consumer, Walmart, Target, Best Buy, a B2C indirect channel. The retailer has direct dealings with the producer. Walmart certainly does that in a big way, as do other leading retailers like Target. Or we can add another intermediary in there, from a producer to a wholesaler, from a wholesaler to a retailer, then on to the final consumer. You're a small retailer in downtown Kent, Ohio. You're a hardware store. How many products do you carry? I don't know, thousands of little this's and that's in a hardware store? How are you going to deal, if you're a single store in Kent, Ohio, with thousands of suppliers? It's just silly. You're not. It's not going to make sense. You don't have the time. So instead, there are a series of wholesalers out there that do that work for you, that bring assortments to you and offer them down to these small, in my example, hardware stores to small stores. So this is the only way that it makes sense for them to sell products. On the B2B side, the producer to the business consumer, this direct marketing approach, accounts for a larger dollar volume of business than does any other channel arrangement. Why is that true? Because what businesses are buying in a direct relationship with the manufacturer are very expensive things. Jet engines, helicopters, oil rigs. You don't sell that, you don't buy that at your local retailer. So this represents very large sales of elevators. So directly from the producer to the business customer, lots of dollars are spent there. On the B2B side, we can go from the producer through a distributor to the business customer. This is an indirect approach. And you would often use this for things like operating supplies, small accessory equipment. Anybody ever see a Granger truck drive around or notice it by any chance? Granger? Granger is, and you'll see trucks sometimes, maybe now that you see them, is a distributor. They have a catalog that includes such operating and accessory supplies like motors, lighting, material handling, fasteners, plumbing tools, safety products. And their revenue is generally from the business-to-business side of the house rather than to consumer sales. So they're going to help those producers get their products out to a variety of business customers in an indirect channel. And we also have producer to the manufacturer's sales rep or to the sales branch, to a distributor, to a business customer. This is the parallel to that small business trying to work with a whole bunch of suppliers. Here we have producers who, don't used by Yoohoo. I don't think that's Yoohoo. Is often used by producers who don't have the resources on their own to call directly on their consumers. There's no Yoohoo, that's producers. Producers who, again, you're a little producer in Ravenna, how are you reaching all these, in my example, hardware stores across the country? You're not. You're going to sell to, well, let's turn around because of the business customer, all these manufacturing plants around the country. Well, how are you going to do that? You're not. You're going to have a rep call on a business distributor who's going to work with a bunch of y'all and get the stuff out to those ultimate shops around the country. Digital marketing channels, obviously a big thing today. So e-commerce, digital distribution, and other internet age developments have added a new way to get products and services to consumers, both B2B and B2C. As you know, businesses can operate both bricks and mortar shops and online stores. Digital-only services can be downloaded directly from the provider or can be distributed through a value-added reseller. So we have a, if you will, new channel of distribution that's brought to us through the internet. The video game industry has shifted over the past two decades. Anybody remember GameStop when you couldn't get anything off the internet useful? You had to go to a physical store or you had to go there and buy the thing? Oh my goodness. And then of course things shifted a little bit and we no longer have to travel to a physical store, although some of us still like to do it. You also could get it through mail order, the physical disc. Then the internet came along. Retailers started selling those products online. So we had the Sega Channel, an online game service that was developed by Sega for the Genesis system, serving as a content delivery system. It launched in December 1994. Wow. The Sega Channel was provided to the public by TCI and Time Warner Cable through cable television services by way of coaxial cable. I imagine it took a while to download those puppies. I don't remember. So the rise of e-commerce markets like Amazon added another major distribution channel to account for as we think about how to get our product out there. If you're following Bezos' initial business plan, the company expanded into selling computer games and music in 98. Selling electronics helped that company to grow rapidly and put traditional electronic stores like Circuit City out of business as people turned to that. So we have the logo for Amazon in 1998. Then with faster networks, gamers cut out the middleman and the physical media entirely, downloading video games through distribution services like Steam. Anybody ever use Steam to download their games? Nobody. Bricks and mortar stores, e-commerce retailers, and online shops still remain viable distribution channels, and video game companies need to factor in all of them if they're going to reach their widest possible audience. So it gets complicated. So omnichannel marketing, which we're going to talk more about in a particular chapter, is the integration and cooperation of all these various channels that we use to interact with consumers. The goal is to create a consistent brand experience. So we would like to have an integrated marketing communication message sent out to our consumers through our physical stores, through our digital channels. We want it to send the same message, build the same image, have the same interaction for the consumers as much as possible. This intends to create a convenient, seamless user experience for consumers that offers many opportunities to buy the product or the service. For example, this omnichannel marketing strategy may give consumers a chance to find and purchase online, in-store, or in a combination, such as buy online and pick up in-store BOPSIS. How many of you bought online and then gone to the store to pick the thing up? Nobody. I find it great at Home Depot. Why should I wander to the stupid house and try to find stuff? Click, 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 come in 2 hours, they got it for me. So this is another iteration of how we can get our product out to the consumers through omnichannel marketing, getting them to use different multiple channels to get to the product. All right, dual distribution is a little less elaborate than omnichannel marketing. This is used to reach two or more target audiences through different channels, and it does avoid total dependence on a single channel arrangement. There's a story a while ago where Pepsi-Cola was delivering Pepsi to, I think it was the Philippines, it doesn't matter for the sake of the example, through a single distributor. They had some rift, they had some problem with that distributor. Disagreement? The distributor said, fine, I'm not selling your product anymore. Now what's Pepsi going to do? They only had one way to get the product there, and that channel was cut. I'm sure they worked out a solution, but maybe they needed a couple channels of distribution out there. So you may not want to avoid a total dependence on a single channel arrangement. Historically, distribution channels focused on the independence of the individual channel members. The manufacturer was out to do the best that they could do for themselves. Wholesalers or distributors out to do the best they could do for themselves. Retailers, best they could do for themselves. So it focused on their individual needs and objectives. I can assure you that in that sort of situation, we do not have a very fast, flexible, efficient way of getting product out there. Everybody's fighting for their maximum opportunity. Nobody's cooperating with anybody else. It's not really a good situation for the consumer.
You've said you've had many mentors along the way. Can you single out one who gave you the best leadership advice ever?
Bob Jagger. I was an electronics buyer at Macy's California, and I was going for the jugular with every one of my vendors in every negotiation that I was making, and I was putting wins on the board. And he pulled me by the ear out of a meeting one day, and he basically told me, you will win every battle, but you're going to lose this war. You've got to create win-win partnerships, or you're never going to be successful in this business. And that was a game changer for me. And I started to say, okay, I'm going to put myself in the partner's shoes in every single negotiation, and that has shaped my win-win business partnership strategy ever since. So what I'm known for is collaboration, and I will tell you that was a seminal moment in my career that he taught me.
So here's Jeffrey Gannett. He's the president, CEO of Macy's, saying, look, it doesn't work when everybody's out to do the best they can do and screw everybody else. Not the best way to work a business deal. How about some sort of win-win relationship? We collaborate on this channel of distribution. So, can you not play this time? So, the coronavirus pandemic accelerated the consumer shift to e-commerce, And forecasts are that many department stores will shutter for good. We'll see what happens. To deliver the steady long-term growth, we believe brands can no longer rely on malls or department stores to drive traffic. Brands have to generate their own audiences and become destinations online. We'll see what the future brings. So this idea of the conventional way of doing stuff, you can see the producer fighting for the maximum for them, wholesaler, retailer, each one was focused on their own goals and objectives, not efficient, not fast, not flexible. And so, in part through the pressure from Walmart, we create a vertical marketing system where the producer, the wholesaler, and the retailer work together. Yes, they're still going to make a profit, but they're going to be much more efficient. So we tightly coordinate our marketing channel distribution to improve operating efficiency, marketing efficiency. Everybody does better is the theory. So what are some examples of vertical marketing systems? Well, one approach is to own the channel yourself, corporate ownership. So this is the corporate ownership of a vertical marketing system. Anybody ever see the big Nike store in Manhattan, New York City? So you go into the Nike store there, it's a Nike store. You aren't going to see a bunch of choices like Adidas and Tom shoes or whatever. They sell Nike. They own that channel of distribution, okay? Kroger's, Sherwin-Williams. If you go into a Sherwin-Williams paint store, they may have some odds and ends from other brands, but the paint is Sherwin-Williams. They own the channel of distribution. Luxottica, I'm going to talk about Luxottica Group quite a bit in just a little bit. So the producer, the wholesaler, the retailer, it's vertically integrated. They own it all. Obviously, it's going to be pretty efficient and pretty rapid change. They own it. Luxottica, the vertical integration of design, production, and distribution of glasses, represents a business model that's unique in the glasses industry. Their company, together with long-lasting partnerships with leading luxury and fashion brands, provides outstanding results. So they have an integrated, vertical integrated business model. They spend time at corporate doing research and development and design. They then create, remember we talked about new product production process. They prototype, they develop the wins, they industrialize, they commercialize the winning products. They're into production of the optical lens. They do the processing of the lens. They do sun lens production. They produce the frames. And so what comes out of this process that they own are eyeglasses. And then they distribute it wholesale. Retail, on the retail side, they have Luxottica retail chains, and they have independent distributors on the wholesale side. They provide customer service out to the ultimate client. They're big in glasses, whether or not you recognize that name or not. We'll come back to them. You can also have what's called a contractual vertical marketing system. It's where we have a relationship based on legal contracts. So in the case of Midas Mufflers, you own a Midas store, you have a contractual relationship with the Midas provider of Midas Mufflers. You can't be selling GM mufflers, if there is such a thing. You have a relationship. Independent Grocers of America has a relationship with a bunch of wholesalers and retailers combined. They work together to provide the consumer with rapid, efficient product. Administered vertical marketing systems. In some cases, there are producers in that channel that are so strong, so powerful, so popular, that you really can hardly imagine how you're going to run a company that doesn't work with these channel leaders. Okay? In the grocery arena, if you're a normal grocery store, of course, if you go to, I don't know, Whole Foods. They have a special channel of distribution. You've been to Whole Foods. But if you're a Kroger's, an Acme, can you imagine running a Kroger's, an Acme, a grocery store without any Kraft products? No, we don't sell Kraft here. Without any Procter & Gamble products? Hardly. So if you want to be successful in the standard grocery business, you're going to work with these channel leaders. You're going to allow them. You're going to cede power to them, because you want to work with them, even though it's not a contractual relation. Okay? So we can own you, channel distribution. We can have a contractual relationship, or we can just say, by golly, I want to work with you. How many channels should you have? As often the case is in marketing, there's no single answer. What's optimal for the firm? Well, the answer is just enough middlemen to reach the needs, wants, and desires of your target market. If you have too many folks out there and there's a bunch of products sitting around, nobody's buying it, nobody's paying attention, it's sitting on the shelves, not good. You're losing profit, you're losing revenue. Too few, well, then there's a bunch of demand out there you aren't fulfilling. Not good, you're losing profit. So it's up to you to figure out what the right number of middlemen is for optimal intensity to reach those consumers. Anything else, you're just wasting resources. While the decision is sometimes seen as a single one, you really have to decide that at each channel level. So what do you need at the wholesale level? What do you need at the retail level, etc.? So there are multiple decisions going on here. Now, how intense should you be? What should the intensity of the distribution be? Well, intensive distribution, man, you're going to be in every reasonable outlet out there. Selective, you're going to distribute through multiple outlets, but not everyone. And exclusive, you're going to distribute usually through a single wholesaling middleman, a single retailer in a market. This actually relates back to things we thought about before. Let's see, what did that say? Intensive retail coverage, selective rather than intensive wholesale distribution. So the idea is that these might be different at the different levels of distribution. What I was going to get to, though, was the example here. What sorts of goods need intensive distribution? Something we thought about before when we talked about consumer involvement. That answer is convenience goods. Anybody like Häagen-Dazs ice cream? Häagen-Dazs? Their original idea was they were so good and they were so special, you could only buy Häagen-Dazs through their own stores. So if you're going shopping, you'd have to go to the grocery store and then make a separate trip to a Häagen-Dazs store. Häagen-Dazs makes a good ice cream. Is it worth a separate trip to their store to get it? Perhaps not. Consumers want more convenience than that, right? Otherwise, they could just buy some Eddie's ice cream. So what they did is, first, only available at their gourmet shops, and then they decided to sell through grocery stores to be more intensive. Consumers weren't willing to do that. IAMS, for years, was distributed exclusively through pet stores, pet supply stores, vet clinics. People did not want to make that truck every time they needed to buy something to the vet. So they added grocery stores, and they moved from number 5 to number 1 in annual sales. Consumers weren't willing to travel, do that much work to get their dog food. So intensive distribution, get it out there for every reasonable outlet because people are just not going to travel that far for it. Luxottica has 6,400 retail outlets in the U.S., Canada, China, Australia, New Zealand, and the U.K. The headquarters in the retail division is Mason, Ohio. Their retail banners, now these you do know, even though you don't recognize Luxottica perhaps, are Sunglass Hut, International Lens Crafters, OPSM, Loman & Pink, Budget Eyewear, Pearl Opticians, Pearl Vision, Surfwear, Sears Optical, Target Optical, Kmart Optical, Cole Vision, Icon, and iLori. And they also own iMed Vision Care, which is one of the leading managed vision care organizations in the U.S. Would you say that's intensive distribution of their product? Wherever you can get it, they're there. Not everybody needs to go intensive, though. For shopping goods, you can distribute through multiple, but not all, outlets in a market. For example, you know Step 2 toys for kids? Have you ever seen those? Step 2, they're the, yeah. And then there's the other one. There's the one that's green and yellow, and Step 2 is red and whatever. So Step 2, you can buy at a lot of places, but you can't find it, as far as I know, at your local grocery store, at your local CVS store. You have to find a store, go to a store that offers it up. This was some example about tools that you could only get at Home Depot. Why do this? Well, first of all, consumers care enough that they're willing to find you a little bit. They don't need you everywhere in every store. Second, you now have the ability to strengthen your customer service, improve your quality control, And you can sort of begin to maintain legally some influence over the prices that your product is sold at in these selective stores. Finally, it might be that people really want you. Specialty products. They're willing to seek you out. Again, I think we've talked about these examples sort of before. If you want a Toyota, you probably want your Toyota locally. You want the Toyota maybe here, or maybe up in Streetsboro, or maybe over in Akron, or you don't want to travel that far for it. If you want a Lamborghini, you're willing to go wherever the Lamborghini dealer is. That's a specialty sort of store. My bottom example, I forget if I've talked about, I think I mentioned Bijan Haberdashery. Bijan is a men's clothing store on Rodeo Drive, and I think they have one store in Texas for the very rich. One example I had from a long time ago, if you could get an appointment to get in the store, you can't just walk in the store. They had hanging from their balcony a chinchilla bedspread, which was then $10,000. My bedspreads are not $10,000, I'm sorry. So people who want that level of luxury are willing to travel to Los Angeles or Houston to buy the product. So that's the idea of exclusive distribution. Oftentimes, like Lamborghini, this is done where the distributor themselves have to furnish either the installation or the repair services. You probably don't want your local GM dealer working on your Lamborghini, I imagine. You want to take it to the Lamborghini dealer, and that's where they're going to control this whole thing. So this was just a reminder from when we looked at consumer involvement. It's the same idea. Convenience products, we want available in every possible place. Shopping products, we can use selective distribution. Specialty products, limited distribution. So we're carrying over from a prior lecture to this example. Now, you would hope, based on everything I just talked about, channel members should want to work together for efficiency, flexibility, getting the product out to the consumer, win-win, everybody makes money. But as you know, you need me to back up? We okay? I can't tell. That's just an old slide we've seen before when we talked about consumer involvement, consumer behavior. And I was just making the connection between what we knew and what we're talking about. But despite the fact you would hope everybody would play nice in the sandbox, they don't. And so we do get conflict in the channel of distribution, which doesn't help anybody. Fighting for control of the channel, it's not good. So if you are involved in getting a product to market, you have to understand the issues related to these conflicts, control for them, manage them. For example, we get channel conflict when a member of a channel thinks that another channel member is acting in a way that prevents the first one from achieving its distribution objectives. We're all supposed to be working together here, and you're not. That makes me unhappy. For example, initially, when the web came out and products were being sold on the web, the Home Depot originally said, "What do you mean, producer? You're going to sell your products on your website and also in my store? You're going to be selling against me? No, you can't do that. You're taking advantage of the situation to sell to my consumers directly from your website. That's not fair." Little argument there about how the channel should work. Early on, Lowe's encouraged its suppliers to go online, maybe to win favor from those same firms. So they said, sure, you could sell directly online, and we'll sell to those consumers as well. Eventually, of course, what happens is they work out some deals, which I think we'll still talk about coming up, where manufacturers will advertise their products and where you can get them without necessarily selling the products directly to you. So our products available at Lowe's. Horizontal conflict occurs between channel members, middle members at the same level, Walmart fighting with Target, or different types of middlemen at the same level, Hartville Hardware versus Lowe's Paint Department. So you've been selling for many years your paints through Hartville Hardware. You have a good relationship. They're a well-known hardware store. They sell your paints in the area, yeah? A Lowe's store moves in down the road, and you say, okay, Hartville, congratulations, I'm going to start selling my paint in Lowe's Paint Department, too. Can you see how that might upset Hartville Hardware? What do you mean? I've been your faithful distributor for years here, servicing your customers. Now you're going to sell against me? So we have this challenge here between what's going on over at Lowe's and what's going on with Hartville Hardware. Scrambled merchandising causes a key conflict. This is the idea where a middleman diversifies into a non-traditional area. I am a local grocery store, and used to be I would carry, I don't know, groceries. It's hard to imagine that's what they used to carry, but they did. Now you can get all kinds of junk at a local grocery store, including small appliances. You can get a GE toaster in your local grocery store. Wait a minute. I'm a local store. I've been selling GE toasters. Now that store over there is starting to scramble up. They're doing groceries and they're doing cosmetics and they're doing electronics. Causes people to get upset. So Kroger's begins to offer small appliances. People get upset. Target housing a Starbucks. You're a Target store. Why are you selling coffee? This causes conflict with other channel members who get upset with what's going on. So why do people do it? Well, the argument is I'm going to sell small appliances because I get more customer traffic in. Why shouldn't I? I'm going to sell that paint because I get more customer traffic in. Why shouldn't I? And of course, if you're the consumer, you don't have to run around when you want that cosmetics and that grocery item and that small appliance. You can just go to Kroger's. And the producer gets an expanded market coverage. Now they're selling out of multiple outlets in an area, even though their old suppliers get, or old retailers get a little peevish with them. So there are reasons for this sort of behavior to occur. I've often thought we should make speed writing a requirement for this course. Speed writing? No? Yeah, I think so. Speed writing? Okay. Vertical conflict involves conflict between firms at different levels in the same channel. This can be quite severe. The producer versus the wholesaler, the producer versus the retailer, as they make decisions that affect another channel member. For example, Anheuser-Busch, at one point in time, said to their distributors, they're called wholesalers, beer distributors, tell you what, you're not carrying, inventorying, marketing enough of our products. We want you to only supply our products to your market, only supply Anheuser-Busch products. Distributor says, what are you talking about? I got 20 other brands of whatever I'm selling here. What do you mean you only want me to sell Anheuser-Busch? No, I'm not going to do that. It didn't work out. So conflicts occur here because the manufacturers think the wholesalers aren't promoting their products aggressively enough, aren't holding enough inventories for them, and they want those middlemen to do more for them. Causes problems. A major conflict occurs when producers decide to bypass wholesalers, sell directly to the consumer, by establishing their own distribution centers, their own websites. And obviously, wholesalers don't get happy when that occurs. You're going around them to sell directly to the retailer or the consumer. Makes them upset. You know Coleman products? What does Coleman sell? Coleman? No? They're sort of outdoorsy equipment. So you get Coleman stoves and Coleman lanterns and that sort of stuff. They decided to sell their products directly to consumers around their retailers, using their factory outlet stores. But rather than piss off all their retailers, they reduced their dealer dissatisfaction a little bit by only selling, or mostly selling, reconditioned merchandise in their factory outlets or excess inventory that those dealers couldn't sell. So they were a little sensitive to upsetting their dealers. Goodyear created quite a fuss for a long time. If you were an authorized Goodyear dealer, you were the only place in the area you could buy Goodyear tires. Yeah, makes sense. I'm an authorized dealer. Then, several years ago, Goodyear decided to start selling its tires directly to retailers, like Sears. Goodyear's conflict with its independent dealers caused hard feelings, flattened the firm's replacement tire sales, and here you can see a sign, I am a Goodyear antagonized dealer, not an authorized dealer. So conflict does occur. To avoid being bypassed, what can you do if you're a wholesaler? Well, for your downstream channel members, for your retailers, offer them improved efficient operations. Offer up order handling that's automated online and simple. Help them watch their inventory, know what they need to buy the right thing, and so forth. And provide management assistance to your retailers. Give them store layout, merchandise selection, promotions, and inventory control that a producer can't do for them. So when the producer comes and says, hey, we're going to cut out this wholesaler and give you this product directly, you say, well, wait a minute. You can help me with store layout, selecting my merchandise, controlling my inventory. No, no, no. I tell you what, let's not do that. Let's go through my wholesaler. They're giving me value. The elimination of intermediaries in supply chain is called as cutting out the middlemen or disintermediation. It creates channel conflict and gets people upset. Black & Decker chose to avoid this disintermediation, which I alluded to a few minutes ago, by not using the internet to sell their products directly to consumers, but rather advertise their products, give product information, have photos, and then direct consumers to websites and stores that carry their product line, avoiding disintermediation, avoiding cutting out that ultimate retailer. So, our relationship with the channel members has many facets to them. One of them is the idea of pricing our product in the channel. So it's been a while since we heard from Gary Chinetti, but he and his partner, both graduates of Kent State, set up a corporation that we heard about a while ago called Garrick. Markets a variety of lawn care products, composting, topsoil, mulch, bark, turf, stone, and aggregate for home and recreational areas. And they do have a little sense of humor. I like the one on the right-hand side there, Moonur product. And so he's going to talk to us a little bit about how, as a producer of these products, he has to think about pricing as he thinks about his channels of distribution, his strategy, their strategy. It's all tied together in an integrated way.
Interesting enough, you ask about pricing. We are currently going through what they call line reviews. And the line reviews with Walmart, Home Depot, and Lowe's is basically, what is your price going to be for next season when we start? And what they've done a very good job of trying to accelerate your season, so you're still in the middle of your season for the year before, and they want to get your pricing out for next season. Well, in this era of unpredictability, you know, what's the cost of fuel going to be in 3-4 months? What is the, how many trucks are going to be available or out of business? I mean, it's very difficult right now to figure out what your price is going to be. So for the first time, we're going to tie it into a fuel surcharge, which says that if fuel prices go way, way up, then our pricing is going to follow that. Obviously, the retailers don't like that because they have a difficult time planning in times of uncertainty. But also, what's interesting is when people think of pricing, a lot of times they don't think of pricing as marketing. And, you know, I know there were 4 P's, there could be 5 or 25 P's, but it was product, place, price, and promotion. And price was an area where everybody said, well, that's the easy part. You know, you just kind of like figure out where your costs are and then add 20 or 30 or 40%. But there's so many other things that come into consideration with pricing. Are these products going to be looked at as a loss leader for your retailers? Is this product going to be used as a discounted product as a promotion? Is the price going to be, 2-for-1? So there's so many different things that you can look at, and it really, really is a function of marketing. You know, in the end, you go back to your supply chain group and you say, let's look at our costs. What's our cost going to be to get this product in a bag or in bulk or whatever it is to the marketplace? to be able to price this product or have this product priced appropriately for your customer. But then now you've got to think about, what's our strategy? Do we want to get this product into every single store in the United States right now, and we need to do it quickly, so we're going to have to price it appropriately, very competitively? Do we have an advantage in the marketplace? Is this product so innovative that we're going to have this window of a year or 2 years or 6 months to price it out very, very high to realize a great profit margin on it, and we realize that our pricing will come down once our competitors catch on? Or how the customer look at this and say, how do we want to position this product in the marketplace? So it's very much a function of marketing.
And hopefully, as you're hearing this, if you're paying attention and integrating the information we talked about, some of these concepts, you're saying, yeah, I got that. Loss leader, all right, that's a member of the channel distribution. I got to think about two-for-one deal. That's what they're doing. What's our thing? Where are we in the product life cycle? Are we in introduction? Hopefully, some of that stuff is lightened up. I'm not sure anybody's awake to be lightened up. So hopefully some things are lighting up as we're talking about this stuff. Logistics management and supply chain, big concepts these days, involves those activities that focus on getting the right amount of the right products to the right place at the right time at the lowest possible cost. So we're talking about something in the news today, supply chain. But we'll start with the idea of logistics management. Logistics management is the practice of organizing the cost-efficient flow of raw materials, in-process inventory, finished goods, the related information from the point of origin all the way out to the point of consumption to satisfy customer requirements. We actually thought about this a long time ago at the beginning of the course. Gary's going to talk about it again. But again, if you want coffee, you do not want to have to drive to Brazil to get your morning coffee, obviously. You also don't want to be waiting in Brazil for them to grow the beans so they can dry the beans, so you can get the beans, so you can grind the beans so you can get it. I mean, just silly. So this is the idea of all the way from that point of origin through all of the stuff that has to happen to get it to you. Supply chain, then, is a sequence of firms that perform activities to create and deliver a good or a service to consumers, or in the B2B world, to their industrial users, and what over the pandemic got pretty well screwed up. It includes suppliers that provide the raw materials as input, the manufacturer who turns those raw materials into stuff, the wholesalers who move the product along, and the retailers that deliver the finished goods, all part of the supply chain. So here Trinetti's going to talk a little bit with us about supply chain management from his perspective. Because I don't want to give up 6 minutes of our time, I'm going to skip that slide and we'll come back to it another day. So Gary talked to us about supply chain management in his industry. So supply chain management is the integration and the organization of information and logistic activities across a whole bunch of different firms in a supply chain for the purpose of creating and delivering goods and services that provide value to customers. It requires the application where my ITIS people, seems we have a couple around here, requires all that back office stuff, the application of information technology that allows companies to share and or operate systems for getting the order processed, scheduling the transportation of the product, managing the inventory, managing the facility, so everything flows smoothly from the raw material out to the ultimate consumer. Now, supply chain management doesn't replace all the things you know about basic management. Instead, what it does is build on your best past management practices. And the notion is that a supply chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Who is your weakest link? Is it your components part A manufacturer? Is it your raw material supplier B? Is it your wholesaler C? Who's the weakest link? You don't want to be the weakest link in the supply chain. So before attempting to worry about managing your supply chain, you got to be sure that you aren't the weakest link. You're providing quality products and services for the supply chain. Otherwise, you're the weakest link. You're doing it when you say you will. so that it arrives where it needs to be for everything to happen in a timely manner. And at the price points they need. There can't be a lot of inefficiencies and waste. Your product has to be priced where it's supposed to be as part of this supply chain operation. Supply chain management usually requires significant changes in a firm's organizational structure because it cuts across all the functional areas and across different firms working together. You can't just say, okay, go do supply chain management. So the responsibility and the authority for implementing supply chain management has to be up at the highest levels of the organization. You can't just say to the purchase agent, go do supply chain stuff, the way the Dilbert pointy hair boss would do. Go do supply chain. Not a thing. Has to come from the highest levels because it requires cross-functional interactions. Supply chain management requires firms to put in place information systems and metrics that focus on performance across the entire supply chain, because you've got to watch for that weakest link. And if you don't have these measures in place, you're going to miss individual units who are trying to cheat, trying to maximize their performance without regard to how it affects everybody else in the supply chain. So you got to have metrics in place to help you watch for that stuff. Obviously, people that aren't playing nice cause problems for everyone. Supply chain management means that you not only need to do a better job than your competition to succeed, you need to actually compete against other multi-firm supply chains. It's hard enough for me to worry about my department, let alone my company, let alone my company and all the other companies in my supply chain competing against other supply chains. So you need to not only work better among the functional areas of your own firm, but think how about you'll partner with other firms to succeed. It's a busy world in the world of supply chain. And that's where I'll let you go. So have a great Thanksgiving. This is the end of the material for Mini Test 12. See you next Monday. Be safe and happy.